Hi, everybody. Welcome to our July webinar. I'm here with someone who I have a tremendous amount of intimacy because I wake up with him every morning. He's the creator of the Waking Up app, author of many books. I'll read his bio in a moment. But Sam Harris and I are going to talk about a number of things. We're talking about meditation first and foremost. We're going to talk about consciousness. What is it? Will robots have it? I want to go into a conversation around AI. We'll talk about if any of you watched the Neuralink webinar from Elon and Max last night, what they are doing there. We'll talk about connecting the human brain to the cloud. We'll talk about the human race. Are we the be-all and end-all, or should we assume that we're going to evolve past ourselves? A lot of conversation here today. Please, first off, welcome my friend Sam Harris. Sam.
Oh, thank you.
A pleasure.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
I'm going to take a second and read your bio because it's rich and it's going to give context to our conversation.
Sure.
So I'm sure many folks watching are fans and readers of yours. But Sam Harris is the author of five New York Times bestsellers, amazing, including End of Faith, Letter to a Christian Nation, The Moral Landscape, Free Will, Lying. I have all the books here to show you, but Waking Up, which is the book that the Waking Up app is based on, which we'll talk about, and The Future of Tolerance, Islam and the Future of Tolerance. So writings and lectures across a wide range, published in more than 20 languages. You also host the Making Sense podcast, which has gotten tremendous following, one of iTunes' best. You have a PhD in neuroscience from UCLA, which is critically important because we're going to be talking about fundamentals of what is these 100 billion neurons, these 100 trillion synaptic connections. Is there more to that, or is it all just in this chunk of meat? For 30 years, Sam is also the creator of the Waking Up course, which we'll be talking about a lot, a lot, a lot. So how often do you meditate in a day?
Well, it's formally, usually not more than once. I mean, and I'll even miss some days, but I spent so much time practicing in my 20s that, I mean, for me, it's something that continually punctuates my life. I mean, it's just not, it's, there are many, many moments in the day where I'm practicing. And, I try to sit formally once a day, but it's not, there's not a linear relationship between time in and actual gains. I mean, there's, loosely speaking, there is, but it matters that you practice. But I'm much more of the school that would advocate practicing many times for shorter periods and to actually know what you're doing, as opposed to just thinking that just logging hours on the cushion is going to get you there. Because the first time, in my first year of practicing, before I sat an intensive silent retreat, once I practiced for a year, maybe an hour a day, every day. And when I sat my first 10-day retreat in silence, at some point in that retreat, I realized, okay, for the last year, I had just been
Sitting on a couch.
Sitting cross-legged and thinking with my eyes closed. It was just, I was not actually practicing. There was no way for me to know that.
And I think about that, right? Because I've, at different phases of my life, sort of tried to meditate and got it a few different apps. Actually, Waking Up app is the one I've stayed with the longest. And at this point in my life, I feel I want to explore my own mind and the universe more. And so meditation is one channel in there. But I can't help but think exactly what you just said, which is going on a 10 or 12-day silent retreat is what I need because I'm so, and I think with a lot of the people who are listening here in our abundance digital community, so just constantly bombarded and by increasing amount of information constantly that I'd never have silence. I never have quiet time.
Yeah.
I mean, can someone get to a state, to a good understanding of meditation in this crazy exponential world 10 minutes a morning?
Well, I mean, the difference between nothing and 10 minutes is enormous, but I think for most people, I mean, unless you're very talented, it's probably going to take more than that to really connect with the practice. It's, I mean, I can only speak from my own experience, but it's just, it's not an accident that for 2,000 years, people have been recommending that you do something fairly intensive to really understand the nature of consciousness from the first person side. And as you point out, we're living in an environment now where kind of the normal level of distraction that human beings were acclimated to has been layered over with a level of technology amplified distraction, which, you know, would be unrecognizable to, I mean, it would be unrecognizable to ourselves 20 years ago,
yeah.
You know, but I mean, to say nothing of our ancestors. But every recommendation you've ever heard about meditation that connects up with Buddhism or any other, you know, traditional stream of this information was given to people who, by comparison, were living the most quiescent, bucolic, you know, like you just go to India and you're sitting in the Himalayas looking at the view, drinking tea. That's the circumstance of extreme distraction and superficiality that the Buddha was, you know, warning you to penetrate, you know. So, you know, we've wandered far afield from that with our iPhones.
And so that's maybe a reason why it's more viable and necessary than ever before.
Yeah. No, I think we need it more. I think, you know, the app as a delivery system is fantastic because it's true that audio is sufficient. You know, audio is on some level better than video. I mean,
by the way, I want to close my eyes right now, just listen to you, so it feels like this in the morning.
Getting primed by my voice. Yeah. Just to clarify, we don't actually sleep together every night. It's just you have the app. So this is a polyamory podcast that we're unveiling.
Let's jump in.
Yeah.
All right. So I want to take a second and talk about the value of meditation in this world today, now more than ever before. A lot of the folks listening are entrepreneurs. They're working hard. You know, we're going to be having on our webcast very soon Matt Walker, who wrote Why We Sleep, and amazing author and book, and trading anything against sleep. But meditation is something that, in this crazy world, is going to ground us, is going to help us think more clearly, more productive. You're not here to sell it, but what's the reason that you suggest people meditate?
Well, I guess there are two main doors you might find attractive. I mean, one is just the sheer intellectual curiosity of understanding consciousness and the mind from the first person side. I mean, so you can't understand everything. There's a lot that is not explicit. I mean, the fact that the brain is doing anything relevant to the mind is not explicit based on the first person side. In fact, you can't even notice that you have a brain, you know, from the first person side. So it's not the full story, but there's a lot that we can understand about the nature of our own minds directly through introspection. So in terms of pure intellectual interest, that's one path that many people take. The more compelling path for most of us is to understand something about the mechanics of our own psychological suffering and mitigate that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we find ourselves to be far less happy than we want to be or think we have every good reason to be. I mean, we're living in circumstances, I mean, as you point out, a lot of amazing abundance. I mean, those of us who are lucky enough to be in the sort of, you know, the sweet spot of our lives where we're not, you know, we're not dealing with acute medical emergencies, mm-hmm. and we're not poor, we're not struggling to survive, we're living in a circumstance of relative political stability, where we're not, you know, worried about the civil war that, you know, is still unraveling our society. So I mean, so the first thing to say is that many people are not in nearly as fortunate a circumstance, and they don't even have the luxury to think about the niceties of human happiness, right? But for anyone who's watching this live stream, I would imagine if you have the free energy and attention to do that, you are in a very select group of people who have the bandwidth to wonder just how good human life could be, you know, and what is the actual foundation of human well-being that we might secure.
So if you haven't downloaded the Waking Up app, I'm going to commend it to you, Sam's book as well, that was the basis for it. And the app was a way of getting the message out, making it easy for people. Besides the morning meditations, 10 minutes a day in the morning, you have some beautiful lessons in there. And one of my favorites is on gratitude. The realization of just bringing gratitude to the forefront of our day is extraordinary. Yeah. It changes your physiology, changes everything. I mean, just take 1 second, if you would. You were on the edge of that.
Please.
Well, I think it's an important message.
Well, when you look at, so if you begin to pay attention to your experience, once you start to meditate especially, you notice how much you take for granted moment by moment. I mean, how much of your experience is one of not actually connecting with the present moment because you're seeking to produce some change in your life. There's some problem you're solving. There's something you're laboring under the illusion that if you could only do these things on your checklist, you would finally arrive at a place where you had good reason to relax and simply enjoy your life in the present, right? We're always trying to figure out what achievement or rearrangement of circumstance will be sufficient to actually land in the present and stay there for more than 2 seconds, right? And that's a mirage that keeps receding if you keep following that logic. I mean, there's just you're always going to have something that you need to do. There's always going to be a mess that needs to be cleaned up. And if the goal is to get to some place where the problems are no longer arising, that's a false goal. Because it's just the sheer nature of impermanence. Any experience you have, because it has arisen, because conditions have come together such that so as to produce that experience, you know, it wasn't here a moment ago and now it's here, by its very nature, it will unravel. Right, so you can't. There's no durable in terms of, you know, just in terms of sensory contact with the world. I mean, there's no pleasure that is so pleasant that it's going to stay for the rest of your life. You know, you put the ice cream in your mouth, and 5 seconds later, it's gone. Right, and you just and every experience is like that. So, the question is there something to be recognized about the nature of consciousness that can anchor us to a more fundamental basis of well-being? And there is. I mean, and meditation is about recognizing that, you know, the self is not what it seems to be, the problem you think you're solving in each moment is not what it seems to be. And to your question about gratitude, you can continually reframe your experience in ways that kind of unlock a different orientation. So that, you know, whatever your problem is in the moment, just think of all of the terrible things that haven't happened to you today, right? You didn't just get a phone call and find out that, you know, your child was abducted, right? So, like, if that happened, how much would you pay to get back to this precisely this circumstance of, you know, being stuck in traffic that you're complaining about, right? You know, you'd pay everything. So, like, you can, this is actually, you know, the Stoic philosophers had an exercise that they recommended like this, where you would just, basically, it's a, you know, just kind of briefly considering negative counterfactuals. You think of bad things that haven't happened, and that unlocks gratitude for the present moment, which is, you know, in all its mediocrity, is
amazing.
So much, yes, so much better than virtually anyone else has it on Earth at the moment. I mean, if you think of all the literally billions of people who would consider their prayers answered if they could have lived, if they could be the person you were over the course of this day, living all of the kind of micro hassles that got you into your office today.
Amazing.
And so taking all of that for granted, on some level it's obscene, right? Because just even within the context of your own life, you know that at some point the worst day of your life is coming, right? I mean, like, none of us are going to get out of here without a fair amount of chaos, right? You know, if it's not happening to you, you're going to be receiving the phone call about someone you love who it is happening to. And the question is, do you want to be trying to figure out how to have a truly resilient mind when those emergencies are happening? Or do you want to be able to kind of train in a context where life is good and you have the free attention to actually, work on yourself in this way? And, you know, I've it's hard to develop a strong practice of mindfulness, which is what we're talking about in terms of meditation, when you really need it, right? It's like it would be, it's a little bit like getting physically fit. You know, it'd be nice to have, you know, 20 years in the gym for the day that you actually need to do something in an emergency. You can't just decide, all right, you know, in the next 15 minutes, I'm going to get in shape. So,
and I think one of the things, the reasons I wanted to have you here, why our community wanted you here, is we're living in a time where the speed of technology is accelerating, and the amount of information we're taking in is explosively accelerating. And our ability to parse it and to prioritize and to feel peace and gratitude in the midst of all of it. Mm. Because why work so hard? Why do all the things we do when if you can't actually appreciate and enjoy it?
Yeah.
So I mean, for me, that's part of what I'm getting out of meditation. I'm just at the beginning of this journey. Waking up to what?
Well, there are several answers to that question. I think the core illusion that you penetrate when you really discover how to meditate is the sense that there's a self in the middle of experience that is appropriating experience. So I mean, most people, the sort of the default state, the starting point for most people is the feeling that there's a subject in the head. There's a thinker of thoughts. There's
behind the eyeballs.
Yes. I mean, there's something in your head, which is you, right? And so most people don't feel identical to their bodies. They feel like they have a body, and hence there's this very widely subscribed notion that the mind is something is in fact separable from the body, right? So the mind is, you know, we have a soul that is, you know, somehow integrated with the brain, but at death we'll kind of lift off and go elsewhere, and that's intuitive for most people. Most people are, you know, common sense dualists, where they think that the mind is something that is in the head and separate from what's physical. So you're kind of a passenger in the vehicle of your body, and that's where people start with everything, and that's where they start to learn to meditate. And so when you ask them to pay attention to the breath or to a mantra or to any object of meditation, there's this kind of subject-object dualism where it feels like, okay, I'm this locus of attention in my head, and now I'm strategically aiming attention at an object of meditation. And then what becomes difficult is you notice that's hard to do because you don't have much concentration, and you know, thoughts arise, you get distracted, you've been thinking about, you know, the meeting you have to have later for 5 minutes, and you completely forgot that you're even trying to meditate, right? Yeah. And then you notice your thinking, and then you come back to the object of meditation. But and even within that context, that dualistic context, you can have some very interesting experiences with meditation. You can first develop real concentration, and along with that, gain access to some very pleasant states of mind. I mean, it's just having a concentrated mind is intrinsically pleasurable, and having a fragmented mind is intrinsically stressful. And so once attention can settle really on any arbitrary object, I mean, the breath, a sound, you know, the sound of the birds, I mean, whatever it is, the sound of traffic, I mean, it doesn't matter what it is, that settling begins to become very blissful in the end if it gathers any momentum. But it still can convey this false sense that you're the subject paying attention to an object. The meditation that I focus on, I mean, there's some concentration practice in the waking up course, but it's all for the purpose of being able to turn attention back on itself and recognize that there's no one in the head, you know, there's no homunculus in there, there is just experience. And what you're calling yourself is, in fact, what it feels like to be identified with thought and not know it. I mean, thoughts are continually arising, and there's just this continuous undercurrent of discursivity and conceptualizing, and it's only at a certain point where mindfulness becomes strong enough and it's kind of directed in the right way where you can just break that spell and realize, actually, no, there's just consciousness and its contents. And there's no, the sense that there's a center, the sense that that there's a thinker or an observer who is the one who is conscious, that's a concept that just can disappear. And then, and when that disappears, it's a very vivid taste of freedom, because that feeling, that sort of cramped feeling of, you know, being behind your face, is this is really the fulcrum around which all of our psychological suffering pivots. I mean, yeah. It really is. And then the practice becomes just getting more familiar with that experience.
So choosing not to suffer.
Well, yeah. So until you know how to meditate, you actually don't have a choice, right? Mm-hmm. So like until you learn some practice of mindfulness, there's no choice but to be identified with the next thought that arises in the mind. And you'll be condemned to live out the consequences of that thought. You have no perspective on it. It just feels like you, right? So if it's a thought that makes you sad, you'll be sad for as long as you're thinking those thoughts, right? And so there is no choice until you recognize thoughts as appearances in consciousness and can let them go. And then obviously thoughts are linked to emotion, and emotion is something that you can also become, it can also become an object of meditation. You can become aware of feelings of sadness or fear or depression. And when you truly can become mindful of them, you recognize that consciousness, I mean, that which is aware of sadness, is not actually sad. It's not. It doesn't actually take the shape of the thing it knows. And there's a real freedom in that. I mean, your freedom in that moment is not predicated on getting rid of the sadness. It's not like, okay, I'll be free once, this meditation will really be working once the sadness goes away.
But it's a detachment.
Yeah.
It gives you choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's dive into consciousness a little bit or a lot.
Sure.
And from there, I want to sort of turn into the conversation around the brain neuroscience and the brain machine interface, brain computer interface.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I'll start with the first. I mean, our brains are if you think of it, a few kilograms of tissue, 100 billion neurons, 100 trillion synaptic connections. Is consciousness, in your mind, all there? Is it within the neural tissue of your brain? And what is consciousness as you define it?
Well, consciousness is, so, I like the definition. I mean, it's a circular definition, but I mean, we don't have a truly reductive definition of consciousness.
I was hoping you'd give me one.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think Thomas Nagel, the philosopher, who wrote in the 70s a very influential essay titled "What Is It Like to Be a Bat," gave us a definition of consciousness, which is really it's this notion that if there's something that it's like to be a system, right? If you could trade places with a bat, right? What would that be like? Would that be like trading places with a table? Would it be synonymous with the lights going out? Or is there some perspective on the universe, some qualitative character that is bat, bat experience? If there is, whatever that is, whether we can ever understand it or not, that's what we mean by consciousness in the case of a bat. It's the fact that there's something that is like to be a bat, if in fact there is. So it is... by definition, a first-person property of a system. It's not something that you can define extrinsically. You can't say, well, consciousness is something we can evaluate from the outside based on what the bat is doing, based on its functional integration with the environment. No, because we can well imagine building systems that are capable of complex behavior that are not conscious. There's nothing that it's like to be... Yeah, presumably, there's nothing that it's like to be our most advanced robots at the moment, right?
But as a neuroscientist and a philosopher, which you sort of take from both perspectives, how far down the evolutionary tree do we
We don't
know. Consciousness exists.
I mean, we just have intuitions about that.
Is a monkey conscious? Is a dog conscious?
In your
opinion?
I have very little doubt that mammals, you know, all of them are conscious. I mean, you take the closest case. You take a chimpanzee. To wonder, I should back up for a second. You can't truly evaluate this from the outside because there's nothing. If you look at a brain, there's nothing that you can notice about a brain from the outside that advertises the fact that it is conscious, right? I mean, we only know that brains are conscious because we know what it's like to be one from the first person side, and we've correlated our experience with perturbations of injuries of our brain, right? So you have neurological conditions that derange consciousness. You have experiments, you know, psychophysical experiments or neuroimaging experiments that where we can kind of map correlations between certain contents of consciousness and states of the brain. There are parts of the brain that are clearly mediating mind. I mean, they're clearly producing a lot of our function, mm-hmm. but it seems like there's no consciousness associated with that level of processing. There are even parts of the brain that don't seem like they're a substrate for consciousness. But so clearly, in our own case, it seems like consciousness is arising in the brain. But again, we don't. The level at which consciousness emerges from information processing, or even in fact the question of whether it does emerge, whether it could be a property of matter that goes deeper than that.
And
right?
Some people have speculated that it's quantum computing in the microtubules of the neutron.
Roger Penrose. I mean, I've never thought that that was a warranted.
But it sounded cool.
If we lived in a universe where consciousness or something, you know, proto-consciousness reached all the way down into the most fundamental constituents of matter, right? Mm-hmm. If there's something that is like to be an electron, I wouldn't expect the physical world to be any different than it is, mm-hmm. right? You wouldn't expect, you know, the table to start talking to you, right? That's like that view, which has a name, it's panpsychism. That view is not something. That is compatible with the data, right? So, on some level, it may be unfalsifiable. In which case, you know, one wonders why even talk about it. But the question of how consciousness arises in this universe is still a mystery. I mean, we haven't solved that. But the question about how minds emerge, that is being solved more and more every day. And we know that our functionality as human minds is directly dependent on what our brain is doing. On the most basic level, the mind is what the brain is doing in each moment.
I think about the question, and I'm curious to answer about, is intelligence and consciousness an emergent aspect of the universe? I mean, and we as humans don't take the time to even contemplate the vastness and complexity of this universe, right? The numbers still stagger me. It's 2 trillion galaxies, 100 billion suns per galaxy. And, you know, I'm just, that, when I stop and I contemplate that, I think about humanity as being almost insignificant in the context of all that, and life being something that must be ubiquitous in the universe. Where do you come out on that? I'm curious.
Well, the strangest thing about that is that either possibility seems equally astonishing. I mean, the prospect that we're alone in the universe, that there's nothing as complex as we are, given the sheer immensity of it, that is just a jaw-dropping possibility. But the alternative, right? But the alternative that the universe is in fact teeming with complex life, that's also, you know, about as weird as a thing is you can contemplate. So I mean, both are that both violate some sense of normalcy. I mean, I don't know what would seem normal. You know, I mean, it just. but I think whatever is the case, consciousness is what makes the universe important. I mean, so if you posit a universe without consciousness, there's no basis to value anything, right? There's no, if you're saying that...
I would almost flip it, right? It's consciousness is what allows us to value the universe.
Well, no, but I'm just saying that if the universe, if the lights never turn on, right, if there's no possibility for happiness or suffering, if there's no event that could matter because there's no conscious system that could ever matter to, right? It's like something mattering for a piece of matter, you know, physical matter, to matter to anyone. It has to matter to somebody. It has to matter to, it has to be able to affect a system for good or for ill. And if there's no such system, either actual or potential, right? If the lights never can come on in this in a universe, by definition, nothing matters. I mean, if it's just rocks, if it's just explosions.
But it could, right, be an electrical circuit that if it comes on, it flips from a one to a zero.
No, but the crucial bit is it has to flip to the one of qualitative experience. It can't just be mere mechanism. It can't just be one blindly propagating cause followed by an event for which there is nothing that it's ever like to be. Right, there's nothing intrinsically valuable about complexity, because it's going nowhere unless there is a, it can affect the well-being of something somewhere at some point, right?
And let's get into some fun stuff. I'm watching our time together.
Okay.
Here. So last night both of us watched as Elon and Max, president of Neuralink, sort of disclosed what their latest capabilities are. And I was, you know, I'd known about the company during its earliest origins. I was blown away by how far they've come.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Ray Kurzweil, who's a dear friend, co-conspirator, my co-founder of Singularity University, very famously has all of his predictions. And one of his predictions that's out there enough that people are starting to question whether it's real or not, is that the early to mid 2030s will have high bandwidth brain computer interface.
Mm.
And last night, the work that Neuralink is doing, in my mind, sort of showed the potential for actually getting there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There are N1 chips, like 1,000 thread connections, and 10 of those would be a gigabit connection coming out of the brain to and from. You know, the question of connecting the brain to the cloud, the connection of the aspect of actually connecting AI and humans, and us, instead of competing against AIs, evolving with them.
Mm.
Thoughts?
Well, yeah, I think it was fairly stunning, just the miniaturization of the electrodes and the threads. And I mean, that was, I hadn't seen the evidence of their progress yet either, so that was a great thing to see. I mean, it's of a piece with much of what we've been talking about. I mean, this is, you know, at one point in the presentation, Elon referenced the fact that, you know, philosophers have this old thought experiment wherein you're asked, you know, what if you were just a brain in a vat, right? Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, we are just brains in vats, right? You know, the vat is your skull, and everything you experience as the world is, in fact, a simulation born of neurophysiology, right? So you have the information processing in your brain, and it appears to you as a world, but the world we experience with open eyes is every bit as much a vision born of the brain as the world we experience in dreams. It's just that the difference is, I mean, clearly the experience we have while awake is constrained to a much greater degree by the inputs, you know,
the laws of physics.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not that, I'm not saying there's no such thing as a world, but what you see with your open eyes is your mind. It is what your brain is doing, and it's not. It is. You know, you have a kind of. I mean, it's almost like having a desktop, you know, operating system, right? You're like you have a you do not have a direct you do not have direct contact with the world. You have a kind of simulation, and so the idea that we could be implanting these devices directly into the brain, and once the inputs are there, the electrical changes introduced will be just as good, yeah. You know, it will have the same kind of verisimilitude as what is naturally coming through your sensory system. That's inarguable, right? And so it's very counterintuitive. So people are, when you think of the prospect of having a brain-machine interface, most people are first arrive at some kind of skeptical doubt that, wait a minute, maybe that just isn't going to pan out at all, right? Like maybe it's just not a matter of electrical impulses. Maybe there's something intrinsically, you know, magical about having a computer made of meat. But we know that the cash value of what's happening in the brain can be understood in terms of, you know, information processing, in terms of neurophysiology, and intruding directly on that will change our experience very directly. Then there's just this open question of what that means to integrate with a level of AI that we have yet to build. And I think, I mean,
so let's talk about AI for a couple minutes before we go to everybody's questions here, because I've been, you know, very, very clear in my view that we have a very dystopian view of the future driven by Hollywood and Terminator and so forth, and that.
Right.
And that AI, in my mind, increasing intelligence, I believe, at least desire to believe, that increasing intelligence correlates with increasing compassion and increasing, I'll use a generic term, goodness versus a dystopian point of view. And that an AI doesn't need to crush us. So there's plenty of resources in the universe. And if you've seen the movie Her, it's one of the lesser dystopians.
Yeah, it gets bored with us
and leaves, right? Because there's an infinite amount of energy and resources out there, and why does it need to even bother us in the first place? I've heard your commentary on concern about AI, and maybe it's concern of AI as a three-year-old child playing with a mallet. But one of the off ramps to sort of the dystopian AI future is we merge with AI versus just let it evolve on its own, and we humans. It's not AI versus humans, it's AI versus HI, sort of increased human intelligence.
Right. Which is very much Elon's notion of how we could sort of tether it to us and then therefore be safe, right?
Or at least combat it properly.
I'm agnostic as to whether that is the plausible route toward alignment. I mean, so the issue for me is I'm skeptical that as you scale intelligence, compassion and wisdom and concern for the well-being of others comes along for the ride. I think that's I think we can easily draw analogies to our own experience. I mean, just how little concern we have for lesser life forms, right? If we learned that, you know, the ants had invented us, mm-hmm. right? You know, how much would that change our whatever their interests are, we can't pay attention to their interests in prosecuting our own, right? It's like if you want to build this building, you got to move a lot of earth. Well, how are we going to take care of the ants? You know, it's like we have priorities that have nothing to do with ant priorities, and it just wouldn't matter if, you know, a million years ago they had done some experiment that they got us running. Right?
Thank you, OAMS.
Yeah. So, I think it's conceivable. So the problem for me and for many people who are worrying about this is that clearly in the space of all possible super intelligent minds, there have to be more that are not perfectly aligned with our well-being than there are the ones that are, right? So it's just because all you're talking about are minds that are more competent to meet various goals than we are. Right. So, you could talk about ourselves with reference to any other species, right? Like it would be possible to have developed a human species that was more or less aligned with the interests of, you know, gorillas, say, right? So we're not totally unaligned, but we kill a lot of them, we forget about them most of the time, we destroy their environment, we put some in zoos, we study them, we play with them, we take nice photos of them, but like it would be, the alignment is dubious at best, right?
I have a whole set of arguments. I will, right. Maybe after our hour here, we can go a little bit of a deep dive, because I'm curious. There is a difference between living in a scarcity mindset and abundance mindset. When you have an infinite number of resources, you have the ability to, but we'll talk about that afterwards.
Okay. Right.
I want to go to our viewers' questions here. And I hope you guys will dig a little more into consciousness and AI and everything. I want to state again, I mean, my primary purpose for bringing you on was really to get the community thinking about meditation in this world of continuous pummeling of data and the ability to extract joy, or at least to choose not to suffer. Because also our community is mostly entrepreneurs, you're going to have a lot of challenges and failures, right? It's being an entrepreneur is really like just pounding until you experiment your way into success in some way. So I think meditation is a critical part of the tool chest for being an entrepreneur in this period of time. Mm-hmm. And just for all of you, for the Abundance Digital members, just a quick note and thank you. We're going to be sending you out a link after this webinar. Sam has extended a 90-day, 3 months of his Waking Up course free for you to try it. And I hope you'll join me as I do wake up every morning. I've been getting up at about 4:30 in the morning.
Oh, and my condolences.
No, it's actually,
that's right.
It means going to sleep earlier
at
night. Meditating and really sort of, it's been a beautiful period of time.
Awesome.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. You're on the Jocko Willink program.
How long that will last, we'll see. But we're going to be going to your questions. We're going to take a two-minute break right now while the team sort of tallies up the questions, and then we'll come back to you. So see you guys in 2 minutes. I'm someone who loves helping entrepreneurs figure out their MTPs and their moonshots and how to leverage exponential tech. In fact, my MTP is to inspire and guide entrepreneurs like you, to help you understand what's in the lab and coming to market in the next 2 to 5 years, and to make these concepts understandable and usable. So one of the things that I'm focused on doing is creating a community. I call this community Abundance Digital. Ultimately, this community is about supporting your mission, keeping you on your game, and upping your potential year on year. This is a community of individuals in which you're gonna find your co-founder, find the person who inspires you. In addition to that, we're gonna have incredible discussion boards. What are the coolest technologies, the most important events to go to, breakthroughs in hacking the human body, extending your healthy lifespan. This is a community where I spend my time. I give my advice, my passion, my inspiration. Every month, I'm bringing into this community literally the best CEOs and CTOs for an hour to 90 minute long webinar where I'm grilling them and then you're grilling them. Finally, is your chance to join me at the Abundance 360 CEO Summit. I made a commitment to run the CEO Summit for 25 years, and I gathered together 360 amazing CEOs. You're gonna have a chance to be there live digitally for the entire 3 days. Ultimately, this is a chance for you to be part of A360 for a fraction of the price. In addition to community and live events, the final part is a curriculum. I've taken the time to actually record 160 videos. These are videos ranging in 4 to 10 minute segments that allow me to teach you what I consider the most important knowledge that an exponential entrepreneur needs to understand today. At the end of the day, you're joining a community of like-minded individuals who want to use exponential technologies to create wealth at the same time that they solve the world's grandest challenges. This is the community to help you make maximum impact for your life and for the world. Please join me. All right, welcome back, everybody. Here for your questions with Sam Harris, talking about AI, consciousness, meditation, whether the human race should evolve into robots or virtual existence, anything you want. Jerem, let's go to you to kick it off.
Sure. So our first question comes from Kevin, and he says, in developed countries, humans tend to fill their downtime with phones and screens. If technology develops to a point where humans don't work anymore and no longer have the burden of a job, how do you think we ought to behave and use our free time?
Well, if we didn't have to work at all, right, which is, I think, a plausible goal. I mean, in a perfect world, or even in a sane one, we will build more and more intelligent machines such that no one actually has to do work. At minimum, no one has to do drudgery, you know, ever again, right? But then the question is, there's two questions. One, have we built the political and economic conditions to absorb that abundance? Right now, currently, if you just handed us the perfect AI, they could just pull wealth out of the ether. We are not set up politically or economically to deal with that.
I mean, I call it technological socialism, where technology is taking care of you, not
the
state.
Yeah. So I mean, so whether it's UBI or some other remedy, we need to figure out some mechanism to spread the wealth around. But so, assuming we've solved that problem, then you have the problem of boredom or some kind of, you know, Aldous Huxley-like dystopia where people are just, you know, spend all their time playing video games that become more and more compelling, or they're taking drugs that sort of medicate their angst away, and we become entranced by something of our own design that doesn't actually seem like the fruition of all of our most creative dreams. So the question is, how do you navigate in the space of all possible experiences when you're no longer prevented from getting exactly what you want, right? We'll need a more intelligent conversation about what's worth wanting in this universe, right? When we can actually pay, you know, we can bewitch ourselves with increasingly, when you're talking about things like, you know, perfectly compelling virtual reality, right? Like, I mean, then you're talking about a circumstance
with a high bandwidth broadband, you know, BCI.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah. It's just directly into the brain. So the question is, do you want to even be living in contact with terrestrial reality much or even any of the time, right? Do you want to be in relationships with real people, or do you want to be in relationships with figments of your or someone else's imagination, right? And that's, I think, so there are lots of ethical questions, you know, leap out of that.
Do you want an answer?
Just kidding. Yeah. But so, and intuitions may divide. I mean, we may find that we bifurcate into different, you know, clans, where there's some people who will be happy to be in a dream world, and there's some people who will, you know, want to get out of the matrix. And I mean, constant to both of those conditions, or any conceivable condition, is the fact of consciousness, the fact that it's like something to be what you are in the presence of some contents of consciousness. And the contents can keep changing. If you take a psychedelic, the content of consciousness change radically, but the fact of consciousness and the fact that consciousness in truth has no center, or that the implied center is a fiction, that's stable, and you know, so I think you know, esoteric things like meditation only become more relevant in the context of that level of abundance.
I was on stage with someone you know, Sadhguru. We were in St. Petersburg together and having this exact conversation in front of, it was like the largest bank in Russia. And it came down, he said something that was very interesting. He said, you know, for the first time ever, we're able to take a break from survival.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, because 99.99999% of the human race, it was about survival. I mean, just literally about survival.
Yeah.
Day to day, we're finding a break from survival. So what do you do when you take a break from survival? I think majority of people talk about it's about love, it's about joy, it's about happiness, it's about that. And so it's going to be interesting because so much of our identity is tied up into who we are, what we do, who we're married to, what our job title is, and so forth. So there's a lot of human psychological and conscious evolution we need to go through at the same but challenges at a very rapid time scale.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and we're not. I mean, the pace of change is such that we're kind of losing sight of what's happening. I mean, I feel like
it's like, accelerating. There's no way we can.
Yeah, I mean, people. I think people have lost sight of what it was like to live in a world without social media, right? You know, and that's. I mean, so something that happened, you know, 10 years ago. It just seems like this has just been. You know, the state of humanity for as long as anyone's been alive.
It's hard to believe that 15 years ago, you know, this didn't exist.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, reminder, 15 years ago. So when Ray talks about high bandwidth brain-computer interface existing 15 years from now,
right.
Will it be interesting that we'll have lost sight 20 years from now of what it was like to live without having your brain constantly plugged into the cloud?
Yeah. Well, that's
something that phone is doing to us now. Jerome.
Yeah, sure. So next up is Leslie, and she's curious how you feel about modifications to the brain in general, be it caffeine, hallucinogenics, BCI, anything like that.
Well, it just depends on what the modification is, right?
So is it reversible?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's that, but it's just like you know, just you to take drugs as a class of substances that we can ingest for their, you know, psychological or cognitive or perceptual effects. It's just our thinking about this is just hamstrung by the fact that we have this one word, drugs, that names all of these substances, and you know that there's, as far as I can tell, very little that caffeine and LSD have in common, or that even you know that cocaine and LSD have in common in terms of. You know, why one would take them, what the effects are, the health implications of taking them. And so, you know, I would just first ask you to recognize that the word drugs is a lot like the word sports, right? So you have sports that have almost nothing in common except for the fact that people are breathing while doing them, right? So you have, you know, badminton on one end and you have MMA on the other, right? And they're both sports. But you know, the implications of violence or injury or fitness or anything else are massively different. So I mean, there's some drugs that are worth taking, certainly worth taking under the right conditions, and there's some drugs that are worth avoiding at all costs. So that's.
I would add on to that. I think it's the ancient. Philosophy of the unexamined life is not worth living. I mean, part of this is your ability to go deeper and deeper into examining your life. So a category of psychedelics, whether it's ayahuasca or DMT, which is something I recently experienced, is about exploring yourself. And I think it's about dissolution of the ego and about understanding more and exploring at a level that you might go your entire life and not touch that and see that.
Yeah,
but in with a teacher, with someone who can help you understand the impact of it and what it means, there's tremendous value. Am I someone who is likely to go and try a brain implant? 100%. The question is, when will I be ready to make to be patient zero? Yeah. We're talking about this beforehand, right? I mean, I think it's beautiful what Neuralink is doing in terms of making the idea of the N1 chips and the implanting of this chip, something that can be done almost outpatient, when you etch your laser, etch your cornea.
LASIK.
So I think that's, there will be a point at which brain-computer interface is a given. Just like having a smartphone is a given. It's interesting, I don't know if you do this, when I'm out lecturing in huge audiences, I will ask the question, does anybody here not have your cell phone?
Right.
And I'll go 50,000 people before I meet someone. And I remember last time it was someone who had left it in an Uber that morning.
Right.
So we become so dependent on this. It's part of our brains, part of our consciousness. It's an extension of ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure the line for the first brain-machine interface is going to be quite as long as the first line for the iPhone. But so the early, it'll be interesting to watch the early adopters there.
Yeah.
The miniaturization was surprising to see, and if they keep improving on that, you could certainly get the sense that it will be the safety issues around it will be more or less nullified, right? And that if it's not like having dangerous neurosurgery, if it's something that is far less intrusive, even though it's actually making direct contact with your brain, I think our sense of what is normal and could be elective will shift pretty quickly, especially if you're given capacities that not only are desirable but make you, fundamentally a different species that from the normal case. I mean, economically, you could imagine a situation where it's just not an option not to integrate with the cloud.
That's part of. We're going to do some more content after this hour, right, so that we'll share it with the community here. But I want to go into that comment. Right. I think we're evolving ourselves into what I call a meta intelligence, and I'd love your thoughts on that. We'll come back.
Okay.
All right, Jerome.
Sure. Next up is Oren, and he says, "How do you manage your own relationship with technology? How do you strike balance and govern yourself?"
Badly.
Great.
Badly.
Great question.
Yes, as my Twitter feed attests. I've pulled back from social media a lot, and that has been an intrinsically good thing, as far as I can tell. I mean, it's interesting to go. I don't know how much pain you've gotten from your experience on social media, but
not as much as I think you've gotten.
Yeah, no, I've.
I respect your standing your ground and speaking your truths.
I whine about it a lot, but it's been painful, but. To step away from it to any significant degree and then to go back, there's something of this, the spell has been broken for me, where I go back and I see what everyone is doing. I mean, from Trump on down and from Elon on down, I just see the kind of the needless complication of people's lives and our own, our own public discourse. And then I see things happening in the real world that would be unthinkable but for the amplification of a certain style of conversation on Twitter in particular. It has more and more the character of a psychological experiment that we've all been inducted into.
It's kind of wrong.
And no one has consented to this thing, right? And it was just the outcome was never even conceived, and it's does not seem at all benign. So yeah, I'm stepping away. I've dialed it down by like 95-98% in terms of my engagement with it, and it's amazing to actually be moving through the real world, the quote real world, and notice that I have a different psychological experience.
I'll tell you, one of the psychological experiments I've done, and I've been very vocal about this, is I'm sick and tired of the dystopian news. I'm tired of what I call the crisis news network or the constantly negative news network, whatever you want to call CNN. And so I do not watch the news.
Yeah.
I have no need for them to tell me what they think is important. I'll use my Google News alerts or friends to tell me if something is critical. But just spending an hour or two a day in this bombardment, because it's all negative news.
Yeah.
Most of it irrelevant.
Yeah.
Jerem, let's sneak in a few more questions here in this hour.
All right, so Victor says that he's assuming you went to a Vipassana retreat for your 10-day meditation.
Yeah, Vipassana, yeah.
Vipassana, thank you. What is your favorite type of meditations, and what recommendations do you have for someone who has tried multiple times but failed over and over again?
Great question.
Well, so, I mean, you know, as will not be a surprise, I'm putting everything I recommend into my app. The book was my first effort at this, but the app is actually a better delivery system for this kind of thing. I mean, actually having guided meditations can be very helpful, even for someone who really knows how to meditate. I mean, bizarrely, even, you know, I can listen to my own guided meditations, and they're useful because it's just a kind of mindfulness alarm. It's just reminding you that you should be paying attention.
It is a night and day difference when I sit there and meditate on my own, and then when I have you bringing me back.
Yeah.
In a very gentle fashion, that's surprisingly not disruptive.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I put, you know, everything I recommend in there. It is a Vipassana. I mean, Vipassana is the tradition of teaching within the oldest school of Buddhism, the Theravada, which has given us this concept of mindfulness. What is referred to as mindfulness in the more secular context is the practice you learn in the Vipassana traditions.
You remember you've done this a number of times.
Yeah.
How many total?
Well, in my 20s, I spent about 2 years on silent retreat. So I did never for longer than 3 months, but I did, you know, multiple, wow, you know, month long and 3 months.
Do you remember
the
first time you went?
Yeah, it was somewhere around 80.
I'm just saying, what was the first experience of the process of letting go, and how difficult was it for you?
Well, the first. I mean, I did it as incrementally as anyone could do it. I mean, I did a day long sitting, and then I did a weekend, and then I did my first 10-day. And I don't really recommend anything shorter than 5 days or a week to someone, because invariably the first 3 days of a retreat are the hardest, mm-hmm, of any length. I mean, you're encountering all your resistance to unplugging from your life, and all the restlessness of just, you know, being in silence. And so you get the hard part front loaded, and then the question is, you know, how much time do you have to actually enjoy, you know, settling in? And if you only do a weekend, basically you just get slammed against the wall of the hard part, and then
none of the benefit of the
year. But then in like 15 minutes you transition to like, okay, I've only got another, you know, 30 hours of this, and then I'll be home. And so you already got 1 foot off the retreat. So for 10 days, it's long enough so that when you get past your resistance, you still have too much time for you to be kind of stepping out of the retreat in your imagination. So it's I do recommend Vipassana retreats. I think Vipassana is the greatest preliminary practice to what I ultimately recommend on the app. I mean, I've been very influenced by the Dzogchen tradition in Tibetan Buddhism, there are other, the distinction is that in Dzogchen, there's an explicitly non-dual conception of awareness that is being taught and introduced, so that you're ultimately practicing a type of mindfulness that isn't a matter of subject-object attention. But, you know, within the Indian tradition, there's a school generally referred to as Advaita Vedanta, non-dual Vedanta, which talks about the same insights into the nature of awareness. They don't have quite the same methodology, but Vipassana, for the novice, mindfulness and Vipassana is the place to start.
For those of you who can stick with us, we can go another 10 minutes of questions here. So Jerem, continue, please.
Yeah, Mary asks if you see any intersection between BCI and meditation. Do you see a future where your app is compatible with Neuralink?
That will take more funding to develop that.
There'll be an app store for that.
Yeah. Well, so even short of direct interface with the brain, I can imagine technology that helps you meditate. I mean, if you can develop a system that will detect those moments where you're distracted, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, there are people who have been working on that. I mean, in various EEG-based ways or fMRI-based ways. you know, you're reading a brain-machine interface would be the most direct way to do it, and I think the way that we'll actually do it without any ambiguity. I mean, I think there's no question that being lost in thought or being distracted by thought is a condition of the brain that we can detect. And if you had a machine that was detecting it and reporting it to you the moment it happens or a moment before it was about to happen, you would get a positive feedback loop and you would be training yourself to pay attention in a way that you can't on your own. I mean, or the efforts you do on your own, which everyone experiences when they try to learn to meditate, can seem fairly arduous. I mean, it's just that the default state of our minds is to be distracted more or less every waking moment. And in the beginning, much of meditation seems like just kind of spectating on the chaos of that automaticity.
Right? Nice. Jerome.
Great. Austin asks how you keep yourself intellectually curious. What sources do you use to keep on the cutting edge of science and philosophy?
Well, there's really no effort I make there. I mean, there's so many things that I want to know more about. There's so many problems in this world that are advertised to us on an hourly basis that for which thinking more clearly is the obvious remedy. So that's, there's easily, I mean, if I look at my own phone, I probably have 10 years worth of reading on my phone that, I am barely going to even attempt to get to, right? So there's thousands of books I want to read on a wide variety of topics. And so I just keep putting myself in dialogue with smart people, both, on my podcast and just, by reading their books. And
let's do a quick injection about your podcast.
Yeah.
Tell us your podcast for everybody viewing that wants to plug into it.
Well, it's called Making Sense. And it used to be called Waking Up, but then when I realized that was the better name for the app, then I rebranded it. But it's I've had 163 episodes, 163 or 4 episodes now, and most of them are conversations with smart people. I mean, people who at least seem smart until occasionally the wheels come off. And some of them are fairly adversarial. I mean, sometimes I bring someone on who I know I'm going to disagree with about something fairly important, and some are just fascinating people who I wanted to read their book, and then I realized I could speak with them. So a lot of scientists, neuroscientists, philosophers, computer scientists, physicists, psychologists, I mean, the last one was Ricky Gervais, so occasionally I have a very funny person on there. So it's a wide range of people.
Nice, Jerem.
Barbara asks, "You are someone who is widely seen as a public scientist and intellectual. How do you counter anti-intellectualism in your career and in life?
Do you tolerate it? Do you engage with it?
I guess I don't really. I'm not aware of encountering it very much. It's like either those people are not
penetrating.
They're not paying attention to what I'm doing, or I it's easy to ignore what they're doing. It's just. I mean, there are pockets of anti-intellectualism that you find
in Washington D.C.
Yeah, politically on the left or right that are fairly predictable. I mean, you can go into fundamentalist religious contexts where there's clearly an opposition between what people cherished as a matter of their beliefs about the universe and what's we have good reason to believe scientifically. And then you can go far to the left and you see strange beliefs about human health or even far to the left politically now you find a basic doubt about whether or not there's any biological reality to sex differences or it's like are men and women different on any level or is that all just a cultural construction. I would say that you can start with the uterus and then start counting from there. I mean there are obviously differences you can get politically amplified hostility to basic intellectual honesty, but I mean, it's a problem that we just have to keep tracking around.
Let's try and squeeze in one or two, Jerem. Yeah, please go.
Next up is Rick. He's curious to know about your path and your career. He's saying, how does a neuroscientist become an entrepreneur? What are the steps you took to create the meditation app, and what do you plan to do next?
If you could do that in just 2 minutes, that'd be great.
Yeah. Well, it's not a happy story that I would recommend to anyone.
Okay.
But I mean, it's under duress, really. I mean, like, I had something that I wanted to build, and I got myself an expensive and fairly painful education, you know, while building it. You know, but it's
how many users are there that Waking Up app now?
There are a quarter of a million monthly active users.
That's amazing.
But I gave at a certain point, people were supporting my podcast, and I gave it away free to all podcast supporters. So and then I stopped once it became a separate business. I stopped doing that. So there are now 90,000 subscribers, but we have a quarter of a million.
Which
users,
I am a very happy one.
Yeah.
Jerem, let's take one more before we break.
This one's interesting. So this is from Raymond. He asks, how you think we would know if we even had a conscious AI? What version of the Turing test?
Great question, Raymond. Thank you for asking it. Right.
What version of the Turing test do you think is most accurate as a quick answer?
So if an AI says, I'm conscious,
and you say
bullshit, where's that happening?
I'm worried about this because I think we will lose sight of this question. I think we will build AI that seems conscious to us. Because we'll build it that way, and so it will pass the Turing test. It'll seem not only human-like, but better than human. And we will build that very likely before we understand how consciousness arises in any system, you know, the human brain included. And therefore, I think there's a real possibility that we'll lose sight of it even being an interesting question ethically or intellectually. So you'll suddenly feel in relationship to, you know, this humanoid robot, right, that never seems anything less than conscious, and it will play upon all of your intuitions that you're in relationship with a conscious agent, and yet you won't know, and no one will know, and we'll basically forget whether that was even a question worth thinking about. It is worth thinking about because it is the difference between consciousness, between the lights being on or not, is the difference between the possibility of suffering and not, right? So if we're building machines that can suffer, you know, that's an enormously significant thing to do, and we should probably avoid doing that, right? But we could be in a situation where there's two extremely different situations we could be in. We could build conscious machines that can suffer and be unaware of it. I mean, we could build, you know, like simulated worlds, you know, on the hard drives of our computers that are populated by conscious entities. Essentially, consciousness could arise in this context and be, you know, we could essentially create hells and populate them with beings and be unaware of it, right? That's possible. Or we could build things that are not conscious but seem conscious to us, and we could be thereafter delusionally concerned about enslaving our robots because it seems, you know, just unethical to make them, you know, do all of this dangerous and boring work because they seem as conscious as we are, but they're not. Right, and so it seems to me that we do need to figure this out.
And by the way,
for ethical reasons,
I would say figure it out soon. Right, we're on the verge of quantum computing really beginning to take off, and whatever that's going to enable in terms of machine learning, and you know, Ray Kurzweil's prediction, which we've talked about a lot, is that we'll have human level AI by 2029. I was just on the phone an hour ago with a friend of mine who's running a super high-end AI startup, and he fully agrees, 10 years. So, I mean, even if we're off by a little bit, it's our lifetimes, and this conversation is a relevant one for sure. So, and one what I think we'll continue, maybe we'll continue it in our sort of bonus content thereafter. Let me just tee up. We're going to be heading next month to Singularity University's Global Summit. We'll be broadcasting some of the content there from live. Salim Ismail, who's the head of exponential organizations, going to be joining me to talk about how do you create an exponential organization? What is an exponential organization? I'm going to be bringing Nikhil Goel, who's the head of Uber Air. We'll talk about where Uber's flying car company capabilities are and some amazing progress there. We are within just a few years of autonomous flying cars with a pilot in the front seat so that FAA allows them to fly. And then Dr. Matt Walker, who's the author of Why We Sleep, will be talking about going into how do you spend one third of your life and why is that important to you. Sam, a true pleasure.
Yeah.
A true pleasure.
To be continued.
Yeah, and in fact, if you don't mind, we'll stick around and talk a little bit more.
Sure.
Take care, everybody.